Iran's President Hassan Rouhani once again criticizes the U.S. for hindering the country's efforts to buy coronavirus vaccines. Millions of Americans lose their jobless benefits as U.S. President Donald Trump refuses to sign a coronavirus relief bill into law. And Hamas strongly condemns the latest Israeli airstrikes on the Gaza Strip, which damaged a children's hospital and a rehabilitation center. Thanks for joining us. Iran's President Hassan Rouhani has lashed out at the U.S. for hindering the country's efforts to buy coronavirus vaccines. Rouhani said the U.S. has caused trouble for Iran to acquire vaccines through what he called wicked activities. He said that Iran will do its utmost to obtain an effective and reliable vaccine despite U.S. sanctions. The president assured that Iran has installed the proper equipment to store any type of COVID-19 vaccine. Tehran has time and again complained that U.S. financial sanctions are blocking access to drug and medical supplies. Barry Grossman is an international lawyer who joins us. When it comes to the issue of the vaccines, Iran has made it very clear that the U.S., even though it claims that humanitarian restrictions are not part of the sanction regimes that they have exercised on Iran, is open. However, Iran is saying that it cannot get what it needs, not just vaccines, other humanitarian and medical supplies. This has been repeated by Iran. What choices does Iran have to pursue this matter?
Well, I think very little, bearing in mind that the UN seems more than ever terribly equipped to discharge its obligations under international law, and the US, along with its special allies, seem more convinced than ever that they're too exceptional to be bound by the very same system of international conventions, treaties, and laws that they all too often seek to impose on other people. The problem, of course, is while they pay lip service to not embargoing the sale of humanitarian goods to Iran, they've made no effort to facilitate the financial transactions that go with the acquisition of such products, be it medicine or other humanitarian goods, and therefore it's virtually impossible for Iran to purchase what is needed in a timely manner. And it's worth remembering that it was only late in 2018, October of 2018, that the International Court of Justice ordered the U.S. In an interim order pursuant to a lawsuit brought by Iran against the United States for violating a treaty between the two nations which had stood since 1955, the ICJ ordered the U.S. To lift the sanctions insofar as it restricted Iran's ability to acquire humanitarian goods, medicines, and products relating to the aviation industry. The U.S. response to that was to give notice to withdraw from the treaty. But we come back to the problem at hand, and it's very interesting. We often hear the United States trying to explain its hostile position to Iran as an attempt to what the U.S. would call liberate Iranians from an oppressive regime, which is, of course, nonsense. But this action shows this contempt for the health and well-being and the very lives of the most vulnerable in Iranian society shows that the U.S. couldn't care less about the Iranian people. And then when we marry that up, as the president pointed out, with the fact that the U.S. has been quite happy to sell nuclear, at least share nuclear technology with the Saudis in violation of the Nuclear Non-Proliferation Treaty, and run cover to protect MBS himself from the consequences, the legal consequences of having people butchered and targeting Saudi citizens abroad that are an inconvenience to him, it shows that the United States is not in any way motivated by a concern for humanitarian considerations, human rights, or for that matter, Iran's defensive conventional missile program, which was of course brought up in the context of negotiating the JCPOA. And the only mention of it in the JCPOA comes in one of the riders, which states that the signatory countries would hope that Iran will refrain from designing missiles for the purpose of delivering nuclear payloads. The point being that in addition to resulting in the suspension of all pre-existing sanctions against Iran, the JCPOA in effect recognized Iran's right, which undoubtedly exists, as does it with any other nation, to have a defensive conventional missile program to defend against other countries that would seek to do harm against Iran. And so all of the complaints we hear from the U.S. trying to justify its belligerency, its acts of war against Iran, and indeed its state sponsorship of terrorism make no sense whatsoever.
Thank you very much for that. Barry Grossman, international lawyer there from Bali. The number of deaths from the coronavirus has surpassed 190,000 in Brazil as the fast-spreading disease continues to rage across the country. The Brazil Health Ministry reported nearly 500 fatalities and nearly 23,000 new cases on Saturday. Brazil has over 7.4 million infections. Meanwhile, Mexico, more than 9,600 people contracted the virus in the last 24 hours. It also registered more than 665 new fatalities, pushing the overall death toll to nearly 122,000. Mexico has already started mass coronavirus vaccinations, along with several other Latin American countries. In the U.S., the number of fatalities has surpassed 330,000, while its total cases are nearing 19 million. The U.S. remains the world's worst-hit country by the pandemic. U.S. police say that they have found possible human remains near the site of a huge blast that tore through the city of Nashville, Tennessee on Friday.
Just the tissues is what you believe, that you found human tissue in the remains is what you believe.
We believe.
Believe.
Could be, but to be for certain, we have to examine it. And once we know for sure, that's, and then we'll let everyone know. But we're investigating it.
Drake said the origin of the tissue remains unclear and that there were no confirmed fatalities. He added that a possible motive for the blast was unknown. Three people suffered minor injuries after a parked motorhome in downtown Nashville exploded at dawn. The blast came just moments after officers responded to reports of gunfire in the area and discovered a recreational vehicle. Police said the explosion appeared to be an intentional act. Correspondent in Washington, D.C. says that many questions remain unanswered about the incident in Nashville.
There's so many variables here. If you look at Nashville, Tennessee, why Nashville? I mean, there's so many other cities. If they wanted to make a political statement or conduct some type of terrorism or something like that, you would think it would be a city like New York or D.C. or Miami or Los Angeles even. Not really Nashville, Tennessee. And the way that it warned people, like I said before, why would you warn people and not only just warn them, but give them a 15-minute warning? Why even 15 minutes? And then if it was, according to how other people reported the incident, that it was 15 minutes and then another 15 minutes, equaling 30 minutes, what happened there? There are just so many questions right now as police try to put together this crime scene. They say they found human remains, and then, of course, they're going to try to identify who those remains belong to. As far as any other deaths, it's really uncertain because, again, this was a very big blast. So a lot of the evidence, of course, is going to be destroyed in the immolation of this bomb and the detonation of this explosive. Again, the motivation here is could be widespread. There just doesn't seem to be any tight correlation for something politically motivated. But of course, this could have been someone who was mentally unstable, and they could have used any reason under the sun to try to justify why they should have detonated a van in Nashville, Tennessee.
Millions of Americans have lost their jobless benefits amid U.S. President Donald Trump's refusal to sign a coronavirus relief bill into law. Trump urged U.S. lawmakers to make a number of changes to the measure, including bigger direct payments to families and individuals. He criticized the bill for offering too much money to special interests, cultural projects, and foreign aid. The U.S. Labor Department says Trump's rejection of the bill would leave nearly 14 million Americans without unemployment benefits. The move can also result in a partial government shutdown next week. Lawmakers agreed on a $2.3 trillion pandemic aid and spending package last week after months of wrangling. In the U.S., record levels of Americans are struggling with unemployment after they lost their jobs due to the outbreak of the coronavirus. British think tank says that China will overtake the U.S. as the world's biggest economy by 2028, after outperforming its rival during the COVID-19 pandemic. The Center for Economics and Business Research said in its annual report that the pandemic and its economic fallout have changed the rivalry in favor of China. The U.S. is the worsted country by COVID-19 in terms of both deaths and infections. The UK-based consultancy group said that China has skillfully managed the coronavirus pandemic with a strict early lockdown. Said that Beijing bounced back quickly from the effects of COVID-19 and would grow by 5.7% a year from 2021 to 2025, before slowing down to 4.5% a year from 2026 to 2030. Author and columnist Eino Tangen says that China is economically more strong to make up for its lost revenues from imports after the U.S. boycotted Chinese products.
Right now, with these tech wars, they're simply pushing China to be less reliant on the U.S., therefore buying less U.S. products. Who is that hurting? It's not hurting China. China will emerge from it with their own independent IP, and they'll continue to produce. Yeah, unfortunately, the U.S., many of the firms there will start shedding employees, and these are high-paying employees, which are going to continue to go down. Donald Trump chose to politicize what is, in essence, a medical scientific issue. China, in essence, followed its scientists. It did. At the time, remember, we go back 9 months, people were complaining that China was taking draconian measures, and they were being criticized widely across the world for imposing this lockdown. But it turns out that this was really the only way to do it. Now, one of the big issues, which for some reason no one is willing to talk about, is tracing. Right now, if you're tracing in China, they do it automatically. You have, anytime you go into an establishment, even your home apartment base, you will be scanned.
The Israel regime has carried out fresh airstrikes in the Gaza Strip, targeting several areas of the besieged Palestinian coastal enclave. In a statement, the Israeli military said its warplanes hit three Hamas targets early on Saturday, claimed that the airstrikes were in response to rockets fired from Gaza. The Palestinian resistance movement Hamas denounced the attacks, which targeted a children's hospital and also a rehabilitation center. It underlined that such moves would not break the Palestinians' will, but would rather strengthen their resistance and resolve to fight for their legitimate rights. The Israeli regime often targets the Gaza Strip, citing similar accusations. Earlier, our correspondent in Gaza, Ashraf Shannon, gave us more details on the Israeli attacks.
Israeli fighter jets attacked central Gaza and also the eastern part of Gaza City. During this airstrike, Israeli fighter jets damaged the children's hospital and also damaged a center that treats the disabled. At least one child was injured. Israeli fighter jets used at least six rockets against the Gaza Strip, and also used artillery fire to attack areas in the east of Deir el-Balah. This has been a grim reminder to people of Gaza of the 2008 war. Around this time, 2008, Israel waged a 22-day war on Gaza, killing and maiming hundreds of people in the tiny enclave. Since then, Israel waged two more wars and caused huge destruction, a huge loss of life for nearly 2 million people in the Gaza Strip.
The Syrian Foreign Ministry has slammed Israel's latest attack on the country, saying such acts of aggression will not go without consequences. The remarks came in a letter sent to the UN Secretary General and the President of the UN Security Council in reaction to Israel's Friday airstrikes in Hama countryside. The letter stressed that continuous support from the U.S. and some members of the Council has encouraged Israel to push ahead with its aggressive approach. Damascus condemned Israel's attacks as a flagrant violation of UN Security Council resolutions. It also called on the Council to assume its responsibility in preventing Israeli attacks. Meanwhile, Russia criticized Israeli airstrikes on Syria, saying such actions, quote, further destabilize the complicated regional situation. Political commentator Michael Springman says the UN remains silent despite Israel's continued aggression.
It's another outrage committed by the apartheid entity that calls itself Israel, and it's done only because the United States supports that illegitimate entity, And the United Nations, which in by and large is the creature of the United States, will take no action because it fears American pressure, it fears loss of money from the United States, and because the United States is a permanent member of the Security Council and can block any kind of resolution. It's unconscionable. The Israelis flew over Beirut and Lebanon, striking at Syria, claiming they were attacking, depending on which Israeli newspaper you read, the weapons production facility in Syria, or they were attacking Iran-supported military groups in the area. Christmas Eve attacks, of course, it's a there are a number of Christians in Lebanon and in Syria, and it's a time for them of preparing for a great feast day. And they were scared out of their wits by the low-flying jets and the huge explosions.
The year 2020 has witnessed some of the most severe crises internationally over the past decades. In Lebanon, it was topped by a tragic explosion, which has been seen as one of the worst catastrophes dramatically changing the political system of the country. Mariam Saleh has more.
Since its independence in November 1948, Lebanon, the small Arab country, has been the scene of a myriad of conflicts, challenges, and political bickering. The year 2020 was not unlike any other year, but even more challenging. As the country was engulfed in the economic, financial, and monetary crisis, another challenge hit the global scene in the form of a novel coronavirus. The first few positive cases of COVID-19 in Lebanon forced the country, like the rest of the world, into a lockdown. This lockdown was preceded by an unseen monetary crisis where the Lebanese lira plummeted against the U.S. dollar. U.S. sanctions on Lebanon led banks to limit cash withdrawals, and queues were seen daily facing banks. Observers look at the year 2020 as being one of the darkest periods in Lebanon's history.
We've lost everything, literally. You know, we've lost the companies, we've lost the banks, we've lost the economical system, we've lost the political system. There's nothing left. And you know, when you have nothing left, the only thing left is humans and their potentials.
The overall system of governance in Lebanon is seen as something that needs to end. Waking up to a new crisis had become a norm until the Beirut port blast. A large amount of ammonium nitrate exploded. The explosion ripped through the port of Beirut, killing over 200 people and wounding over 6,500, destroying large parts of the city. With a multifaceted crisis in the Mediterranean country, the explosion in the Beirut port in August of 2020 only served as an additional, unprecedented blow and a national tragedy for all Lebanese. However, politicians and the media remained intensely at odds.
We're used to, you know, Israeli attacks. We're used to having a little bit of, you know, security incidents on the ground. But we have never been used to something so huge. As huge as it is, I guess it was great for uniting the Lebanese over, you know, a cause. At this time and during the blast, we didn't find part of the Lebanese being happy for, you know, blasting another part of Lebanon. It was like, you know, general for all sects, for all people. And I guess it was a turning point because Sayyid Hassan Nasrallah said that at this point we really need to rethink the political system in Lebanon. It was the first time he ever said that publicly on air.
Following the blast, Prime Minister Hassanna Diab was forced to step down in respect for the victims. Investigations into the blast are still pending. Same goes for talks on forming a new government. Although the majority of Lebanese factions agreed to name Saad Hariri as prime minister, it seems the year 2020 will end and the formation of a new government remains in limbo. Mariam Saleh, Beirut.
That's all the time we have for this edition of World News. So bye-bye for now.
Iranian Radio, Global Mission. This is IRIB English Radio. please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
In the limelight.
The Yemeni Minister of Health says the military onslaught by Saudi Arabia and its regional allies has claimed the lives of over 3,800 Yemeni children in the crisis-hit Arab country. Whilst more than 400,000 minors are acutely malnourished and require urgent care. Speaking at an annual medical conference in the capital Sana'a, recently, Taha al-Mutawakkil said children are among the groups that suffer the most as a result of the Saudi-led aggression and siege of Yemen, noting more than half of children in Yemen are severely malnourished, and the military alliance does not shy away from targeting children's hospitals. The Yemeni health minister, Taha al-Mutawakkil, then pointed to the Saudi-led air attack that hit a school bus at a crowded market in the northern Yemeni province of Sa'dar back on 9th of August 2018. That attack martyred 51 people, including 40 children, saying the strike is a clear example of the extent of crimes being perpetrated by the Saudi-led military alliance against Yemeni children. He also criticized as a great shame the decision by UN Secretary-General Antonio Guterres on 15th of June to remove the Saudi Arabia-led military coalition from an annual blacklist of child killers. We now present you an article written by Rosemary Misdery under the heading, Story of One-Year-Old Abdullah is Story of Yemen. The article was published on NPR.org's website. Please stay with us for more of Rosemary Misdery's article. As Muhammad Yusuf tries to calm his crying son, he says, "Losing my child whilst I'm watching is breaking my heart." He added, "I feel so worried for my son. I won't rest until my son is completely healed." Muhammad Yusuf lives in Yemen. His one-year-old son Abdullah has been at a health facility in Sana'a, the capital city, where doctors are feeding him reconstituted milk from powder formulated for children with malnutrition to keep him alive. Abdullah's attending clinician, Dr. Abdul Malik Muhammad, says, "On 5th of December, he weighed just 6 pounds on his fifth day of treatment for severe acute malnutrition. That's less than one-third of the average weight for his age. The doctor's diagnosis of severe acute malnutrition is a medical classification reserved for the worst cases of malnutrition. Yusuf and his wife, Fadia, traveled 15 hours by bus through dozens of military checkpoints to bring their child to the medical facility in Sana'a, the capital. According to the United Nations reports, In Yemen today, nearly half of children are severely malnourished. The five-year-old war in Yemen has caused the country to plunge deeper and deeper into poverty, poverty that has been exacerbated by floods and locusts. And even when there is food available, a three-year-old Saudi-led blockade restricts goods coming into the country by land, sea, and air. The resulting delays increase the cost of basic necessities like food. And for many Yemenis, any price is too high. Yusuf lost his job as a farm laborer last year when farmers couldn't get diesel required to run the pumps for irrigation and drinking water because of fuel shortages caused by the war. Now his family depends completely on aid, which he says allows them to eat one small daily meal. In fact, 80% of Yemenis are dependent on aid, and it's often not enough to avert tragedy. Yusuf says his two older children died of malnutrition, his firstborn at the age of 6 months, and his second child at the age of 4 months. He says both children died during treatment at a health center near their rural village in Taiz, which he says lacked basic medicine and medical staff. Samuel Mabuto, a nutritionist specializing in severe child malnutrition for the humanitarian group International Medical Corps, says fighting in Taiz makes it difficult for parents to get medical attention for their children. Samuel Mabuto has worked through two previous famines, first in his native Uganda and then in southern Sudan. He says children and conditions in Yemen are much worse because the blockade restricts access to aid. This is his third year in Yemen. During his 9 years of practice, Samuel Mabuto has measured the arm circumference of many children, a major indicator of malnutrition. He uses a small tape measure-like device called a MUAC tape, mid-upper arm circumference. He wraps it around the child's arm like a hospital bracelet, inserting the end of the tape into a slot and pulling it through to adjust to the width of the arm. If the arm circumference is in the range of about 5 to 10 inches, the child is in the green zone, indicating a healthy size. From 4.5 to 5 inches on the tape is a narrow yellow section that indicates moderate malnutrition. Then the MUAC tape is red from 4.5 inches until it ends. When children measure in the red zone, they have severe malnutrition. Samuel Mabuto has seen arms that measure as little as 3 inches around in Yemen. At the 27 facilities where Mabuto manages nutritional programs, he says that nearly all the children he sees measures in the yellow and red parts of the tape. Samuel Mabuto says the signs of malnutrition are evident in their sunken eyes, in cases of diarrhea, ribs protruding in sharp relief, and knees like chicken drumsticks. Mabuto says once the child is sick, their faces show sadness. The mother is also sad. Then you see signs of hopelessness, adding, they don't know what will happen the next day. He says recovery can require up to 2 months of close monitoring and feeding. Other doctors interviewed by NPR have witnessed similar distress. Dr. Wafar Al-Salali leads a team of nutritionists for International Medical Corps in southern Yemen. She says most of the children admitted to their health center are severe cases of malnutrition. Her colleague, Thuraya Salam, a nutritional nurse in western Yemen, says the feeding centers are crowded and malnutrition cases are compounded by cholera and diphtheria. Wafar Al-Salali says, when I see the children in the feeding ward, I'm fearful and worried, adding, watching the collapse and weakness of the health system is the most difficult thing for me as a doctor during the war. At the health center in Sana'a, Dr. Mohammad measures and weighs children during visiting hours. He tells NPR he believes the one-year-old Abdullah, with an arm measurement of just 3.2 inches, will survive. The doctor says a few beds away is a severe case that he thinks will also survive, a 16-month-old infant called Zayed Ali. After a month of treatment, Zayed Ali weighs the same as Abdullah, 6 pounds, with an arm circumference that measures just 2.8 inches. The doctor has seen an influx of families traveling from distant rural areas of the country seeking medical care for their children in the capital, Sana'a. He says it's a significant indication to him that malnutrition has worsened in Yemen. Samuel Mabutu says even if a child, like one-year-old Abdullah, survives and is discharged from the feeding center, his parents will still have to continue his feeding treatment at home. And if there is a lack of food at home, it is likely the child will relapse. The UN predicts the situation in Yemen will worsen. It projects a famine in the next 6 months, with well over half the country malnourished. Antonio Guterres, Secretary General of the United Nations, in a statement last month warned that Yemen is now in imminent danger of the worst famine the world has seen for decades. Antonio Guterres added, "In the absence of immediate action, millions of Yemeni lives may be lost." Dr. Mohammad, who sees only a couple of beds free in the feeding ward where he works, for now says the famine already exists, adding, "It has gotten worse to the point that it has become out of control." The Yemeni Minister of Health says the military onslaught by Saudi Arabia and its regional allies has claimed the lives of over 3,800 Yemeni children in the crisis-hit Arab country, where more than 400,000 minors are acutely malnourished and require urgent care. Speaking at an annual medical conference in the capital, Sana'a, recently, the Yemeni health minister, Taha al-Mutawakkil, said children are among the groups that suffer the most as a result of the Saudi-led aggression and siege, noting more than half of children in Yemen are severely malnourished. And the military alliance does not shy away from targeting Yemeni children's hospitals. The Yemeni health minister, Mutawakkil, then pointed to the Saudi-led air attack that hit a school bus at a crowded market in the northern Yemeni province of Sa'dar back on 9th of August 2018. That brutal attack martyred 51 people, including 40 Yemeni schoolchildren. Dr. Mutawakkil said the strike, that airstrike, is a clear example of the extent of crimes being perpetrated by the Saudi-led military alliance against Yemeni children. He also criticized as a great shame a decision by the United Nations Secretary General Antonio Guterres on 15th of June to remove Saudi Arabia-led military coalition from an annual blacklist of child killers. Dr. Mutawakkil said, "The previous regime did not offer any medical facilities concerning pediatric medicine and surgery. The high rate of congenital malformation among Yemeni children is due to weapons being used by the Saudi-led coalition and its bombardment campaign." The Yemeni health minister, Dr. Taha Mutawakkil, went on to lambast the UN's negligence, stating that the world body has so far failed to take any measures to save the lives of conjoined twins who were born recently at Al-Sabin Hospital in Yemen. Saudi Arabia and a number of its regional allies launched a devastating war on Yemen in March of 2015, with the goal of bringing the government of former fugitive President Abdurrahman Mansour Hadi back to power and crushing the popular Ansar Allah movement in Yemen. Earlier this month, the United Nations Office for Coordination of Humanitarian Aid, OCHA, put the death toll from the Saudi-led war in Yemen at 233,000. The Ansar Allah movement, backed by the Yemeni army, has been defending Yemen against the Saudi-led assault, preventing the aggressors from fulfilling their objectives of an atrocious war.
Hopes that Lebanon would have a new government before the end of the year have been dashed with Prime Minister-designate Saad Hariri warning of clear complications hindering the birth of the new leadership. Speaking on Wednesday after his 14th meeting with President Michel Aoun, Hariri said that despite attempts to halt Lebanon's collapse, the existing political problems are clear. International pressure, especially from France, for Beirut to draw up a government committed to reform has also failed to end the stalemate. The political impasse raises fears over Lebanon's growing poverty levels, with a number of poor likely to exceed half the population by the year 2021. The country has been without a government since August, after then-caretaker Premier Hassan Diab resigned following a deadly port blast in the capital, Beirut. For more on that story, we're first joined by our correspondent, Mariam Saleh, who's with us from the Lebanese capital, Beirut, with an update. Mariam, what are these complications that the Prime Minister-designate Saad Hariri has mentioned?
Well, basically, Saad Hariri, I think he has reached a state where he knows that he cannot form a government on his own. And this is what this is something he was trying to push for without getting the consent of other parliamentary blocs. And namely, he needs to get the consent of the president. And it seems the president has several remarks on the way, whether the method of forming the government, which Prime Minister Hariri is going through, or even the names of the cabinet ministers, how the portfolios are being divided. Now, it's true that most blocs have agreed that we need to get out of the sectarian system. However, in light of the current parliament, president is stressing, and other parliamentary blocs are also stressing, that he would need to get the prime minister would need to get the consent of the parliamentary blocs, which are unfortunately divided based on sectarian basis. However, it seems there are other complications. Some analysts are saying that Prime Minister Saad Hariri is actually waiting for the term of U.S. President Donald Trump to end, and when we have a new president in the U.S., then perhaps there would be less pressure on Lebanon, on its government, in order to isolate Hezbollah and not include them in a government, or at least not include people who are allies of Hezbollah or close to them in the current government. Now, this will all, of course, show after the new year, but for now, we don't seem to have any sign that we will be forming a government, of course.
All right, thanks a lot, Mariam. That was our correspondent, Mariam Saleh, joining us from the Lebanese capital, Beirut. Also joining us on this debate, we have activist and political commentator Laith Maarouf, who's also with us from the Lebanese capital. Okay. Mr. Maarouf, welcome to the program. Well, Saad Hariri said that despite attempts to halt Lebanon's collapse, the existing political problems are clear. What is the nature of these stumbling blocks?
The nature of the stumbling blocks for forming a government right now is specifically the demands coming from the imperial powers, which is that they don't want to have Hezbollah represented in the government, and they want to break the alliance between the Free Patriotic Movement, the party that the president owned, belongs to and is a founding member of. And this is unacceptable, obviously, for the country. The majority of the population are represented by these two parties, and they have a clear majority in the parliament. So to try to exclude those and pretend that you can have what is called a technocrat government, which there's no such thing. Everybody has a political affiliation in this country and on this planet in general. Everybody has a political opinion. So, and the governing of states is politics in its day. So excluding the representatives of Hezbollah or the Free Patriotic Movement means a abandonment of democracy in this country.
Let's bring in lawyer and political commentator Edward Corrigan, who's with us from London, Ontario. Mr. Corrigan, welcome to the program. Looking back at some of the grievances of the Lebanese protesters, one must think, does the Prime Minister-designate Saad Hariri wield the solution, or is he himself part of the problem? Mr. Corrigan? All right, I believe we've still not established that connection. I'm going to redirect that question to our guest in the Lebanese capital. Beirut, Mr. Maruf. Mr. Maruf, I'm not sure if you got the question there. I'll just repeat it. Is Saad Hariri part of the solution, or is he still part of the problem?
He's definitely part of the problem, especially that he didn't learn the lesson from the previous government that he led the last time. It was, that he was chosen to be prime minister of the country. It ended up with him being kidnapped in Riyadh, strapped to a chair and slapped silly to resign on live broadcast from the capital of Saudi Arabia. And at the time, his skin was saved by Hezbollah and President Aoun. That brought him back safely to this country and allowed him to form a government at the time, given the situation. So Mr. Hariri should have learned at that time that he cannot depend on foreign powers to dictate what kind of government he has to form, and that he should have actually started cooperating with his compatriots in Lebanon and joining the Lebanese consensus in forming a government with Hezbollah and the Free Patriotic Movement.
So basically, is this just a rerun of the past, in your opinion? Has the old political show once again taken center stage with the same players and the same demands?
Definitely. You see, Saudi Arabia and the United States were not happy with the outcome of that first Hariri government, national government, and we saw the demonstrations that were triggered by awful decisions made by ministers that were kind of counted on the Saudi camp within that government that Hariri had at the time. We saw the collapse of the country's economy under the pressures of American sanctions and destruction of the banking system. And now Hariri had a chance that was given to him once more by Hezbollah and the Free Patriotic Movement. And I don't know if he learned the lesson. So we're all waiting for either war to start in the region in the next 20 days before the inauguration in the United States, and or a coming of a new president that can lift some of the pressures that allow actually some decision-making to be made in Lebanon without threats of bombings.
Mr. Maruf, you just mentioned Saudi Arabia not being happy with the recent outcome in Lebanon. What was the outcome that they were looking for?
They were looking for either stripping Hezbollah of any representation in the government, which means that the government will be totally under the influence of Saudi Arabia and by extension Israel in the United States, and therefore keeping Hezbollah in a corner in Lebanon under threat, and or for a total collapse of the country with armed conflict in the streets that returned to a civil war. We saw that in the last few months with threats from the Falange of arming their militias. So we have, that's what the empire's only choices that are being put forward. Maybe with Biden, things will change.
All right, if I'm correct now, we have Mr. Edward Corrigan back with us, but he's on the line from London, Ontario. Mr. Corrigan, if you're with us, I'm going to address some of the earlier questions to you to get your perspective on the political situation right now in Lebanon. Saad Hariri, he said that despite attempts to halt Lebanon's collapse, the existing political problems are clear. Talk to us about these problems and these complications.
Well, Lebanon is a political mess at the present time. Its economy is in a terrible state. The Lebanese pound has lost 80% of its value against the U.S. dollar, and you have the complication of the big Beirut explosion, which everybody's trying to attribute blame to. And so you have a political situation and economic situation that is, poses to disaster as you can. Now, the politics, Lebanon's politics is very unusual. It's a confessional base, so each religion has a set number of of representatives in the parliament. It was originally set up in 1943 with a ratio of 6 Christians to 5 Muslims. But then in the 1989 TAF agreement, they changed it to 50-50. So it's 50% Christian, 50% Muslim. So you've got a breakdown of all the different groups. Now, the problem is that the Christian population has decreased significantly in Lebanon, and for sure the Muslim population is in a large majority. The Shia population is probably the largest single group in Lebanon, but only has limited power. They're equated with the same power as the Sunnis in Lebanon, and I think everybody would agree that the Shias are much larger than the Sunni population. But the problem with the current is you've had, like, this is like the third attempt government, and Hariri was a former premier of Lebanon when a lot of the problems occurred, and there was, you know, rampant corruption and you know, political problems and infighting with the occasional assassination by various parties, including Hariri's father, who was the prime minister of Lebanon and a respected individual and had a lot of money, a lot of ties to Saudi Arabia in that. But now we have a problem where Hariri put together a list. He supposedly didn't consult with the president, Michel Aoun. And then also some of the parties wanted to have veto power. They wanted to have at least, you know, 3 of the cabinet positions, which would give them veto over the government. And so they haven't been able to come to an agreement. And you have the party split, but there's no agreement yet with the president or with the premier, and of course the political parties themselves. So it's been that way for months, and they seem to be unwilling to come to an agreement. And of course France is interfering, as is the United States. The United States has put sanctions against several leading Lebanese politicians because they refuse to disown Hezbollah. Hezbollah is one of the largest parties in the parliament, and it represents, has 12 seats out of the Shia population. It's probably the best organized, most powerful political force in Lebanon itself, but of course the Americans don't like that, and of course the Israelis don't like that. And as a result, nothing has been resolved to date. And until they get over their petty personal differences, and they really need to reform the political system from front to bottom, and they need to actually break out of this confessional system that locks everybody into their own particular religious community and creates barriers for them to build bridges towards other communities.
Laith Maarouf, Hariri recently met with U.S. Ambassador to Lebanon, who stressed that Hezbollah must not be present in the cabinet, neither directly nor via proxy. In the past, we recall Hezbollah warned that the current U.S. administration is in fact responsible for obstructing efforts to form the government in Lebanon. What are Washington's motives?
Washington's motives is trying to isolate Hezbollah inside Lebanon, and by doing so, hoping that they can agitate enough in the government, if they have control of it and Hezbollah doesn't have any influence, to agitate to disarm them. And we know this is a dead end in Lebanon, and Hezbollah has already made it clear that they will not accept having no representation in the government, given that they won the most seats out of any party in this country. And, you know, although sectarianism in politics is a big problem in Lebanon, even if there's an election that is on a secular basis, there wouldn't be much change in the number of seats that each party that we have right now represented will get. And so the truth of the matter is, the problem is not what is written in law, is the how things are implemented. So if a true implementation of either a sectarian electoral system or a secular one happen, Hezbollah should be represented in forming the government, because it is one of the biggest winners, along with the patriotic movement of Aoun, the party there. So here is the dilemma. Democracy is allowed by the West only if it results in leadership that is in servitude to the empire. If democracy presents results with sovereignties, like in Bolivia, in Venezuela, in Syria, in Iran, in Lebanon, then those people and their democracy and their state will be targeted.
Mr. Corrigan, regionally, who benefits from uncertainty and instability in Lebanon?
Certainly the Israelis do, because they've always wanted to target Lebanon as the weakest state in the area because of its religious division. The Americans and Bush, or the Trump administration, are trying to, help Israel and extend its own influence. And France is actually interfering in Lebanese politics and making pushes and demands that are inappropriate, quite frankly, but also they're trying to reestablish the old French sort of colonial dominance of the area, which, of course, is getting pushback from people in Lebanon. The countries that will benefit are certainly Israel. You could argue also that maybe Saudi Arabia and some of the other Sunni countries who have supported Hariri in the past also might benefit a little bit, but out of chaos, there's I think opportunity for nobody really. Israel has constantly been violating Lebanon's airspace and using it to attack Syria and even launch its own attacks on Lebanon itself. So the Israelis certainly benefit from a weak Lebanon, but some of the Western powers who are against supporting Israel also seem to probably benefit from this, and they're trying to force Lebanon to bow to its wishes and exclude Hezbollah, which, again, as the previous speaker indicated, is like one of the largest, if not the largest, party in Lebanon, and is really the strongest political group in the country. So it's part of the government, and we can't say, oh, they're terrorists. Actually, Hezbollah doesn't meet the definition of a terrorist country. They're defending their own country against a foreign occupier, and have a lot of support even within the Christian community and the other communities that existed in Lebanon. And it's a very fractured country with many different divisions. But and of course, as I said, the demographics are still out of whack, because the Sunnis and the Shia are certainly larger than the Christian population, with the Shias probably being the number one group. But to break out of that rigid formula where you have to compete and get votes only from your own religious group is, I think, a step that Lebanon's going to have to make at one point. But I agree with the previous speaker. The breakdown on, nationalism issues and Palestinian issue and, sovereignty would probably be very similar to what the current breakup of the Lebanese parliament is. But also there's egos involved where people want to have a veto on the government, or they want to have control of the defense ministry, the finance ministry, whatever. There's a lot of that infighting going on, and as a result, they can't have any agreement. But Aoun's son-in-law is head of the Christian party, and there's a rivalry there between Hariri and Aoun that goes back to the Civil War. So they need to really almost have a clean slate, have a new set of politicians that will not have the baggage that the other ones do.
Laith Maruf, let's turn our attention to the round after round of U.S. sanctions against Lebanon. These sanctions have been called an act of aggression against all of Lebanon. Why is the U.S. piling on the pressure when the nation is so obviously suffering?
Hoping to rally the population against the government and the political elite in Lebanon and create upheaval that either results in the expulsion of Hezbollah from government and or civil war. This is the formula done everywhere. This is the main reason for the use of sanctions as a weapon by the Western powers led by the United States. When we see that happening in Venezuela, we see that happening in Iran and Syria and North Korea and Cuba, any country that its people are on side with sovereignty will be sanctioned in order to starve that population to the point where they're willing to give in to imperialism and colonization just to be fed. So that's what's happening. And we can see that sanctions haven't worked in Iran, haven't worked in Syria, haven't worked in North Korea, in Cuba, half a century of that. And that's why we're at the stage where apartheid Israel fires four cruise missiles just off Beirut last night and woke up my children's Christmas night, the Merry Christmas to our Christian viewers around the world, and threats of attacking Iran directly are being made by the United States with the deployment of nuclear submarines in the Gulf. That's even one of the scariest threats that we've had since the Cuban missile crisis.
All right, we're out of time. I'm sorry to interrupt you there. Allow me to thank my guests, a lawyer and political commentator, Edward Corrigan, joining us on the line from London, Ontario. Also thanks to activist and political commentator, Mr. Laith Maruf, joining us from the Lebanese capital, Beirut. Also special thanks to you all for staying with us on this debate.
This is IRIB English Radio. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/EN.
Ask the followers of the remembrance if ye know not.
You're listening to the program The Key on IRIB English Radio with Shiraz Hossein Agha, a graduate of Islamic Seminary of Rome and a PhD in philosophy.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Welcome to our program, The Key, here at IRIB English Radio. I'm your host, Shiraz Agha. Thank you for joining us here today.